Hi, Mark Thompson here from the House of Commons podcast. Just a quick word before this episode starts. When we recorded this, we, as you will hear, had a debate about the police and about the tactics and things that they've done in various cases. And I raised the case of Ian Tomlinson. I stated something that I then, before we released this, I thought I should double check, and it turns out I was a little bit wrong in one of my facts. So I said during the recording that I thought that some police officers who witnessed what happened with Ian Tomlinson then issued statements saying that they hadn't seen anything, and then only changed their statements after footage was released that showed that they hadn't been telling the truth. But actually, that isn't what happened. They did actually put statements in that said what they'd seen, but those statements weren't released to the public. They were kept internal, and there were some questions over who did and didn't see them, such as the person overseeing the autopsy, etc. But I just wanted to set the record straight. I didn't edit that bit because I didn't want to break up the flow, and it's kind of integral to the discussion. But I just wanted to make clear at the start that I got that bit a little bit wrong, but I don't think it really detracts from the overall discussion, because there are of course other examples of where the police have covered things up, as we all know. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and also regularly featuring my co-host, Labour blogger Emma Burnell. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. And we are delighted to be joined tonight by Lib Dem blogger and activist Jenny Rigg. Hi, Jenny.
Hello, Mark. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Jenny.
Okay, so the first thing that we thought we would talk about today is that Nick Clegg has been having a pop at Conservative policy, which is a bit of a blast from the past. It's quite nice to see, actually. And he's basically got a problem with free schools and some aspects of the way that Michael Gove has been going about this. So there's a bit of a quote here. I'll just read it. It says, it makes no sense to me to have qualified teacher status if only a few schools have to employ qualified teachers. What's the point of having a national curriculum if only a few schools have to teach it? Let's teach it in all our schools. And what's the point of having brilliant new food standards if only a few schools have to stick to the rules? Let's have quality food in all our schools. That's just a little flavour of what he's saying. So clearly it's a split, in quotes, although the fact that you've got two different parties in government would surely explain that the splits are baked in. But Jenny, what do you think about this? Do you think it's a good thing that Clegg's out there kind of banging the drum in the 18 months before the next election, making it very clear there are still, you know, big policy differences?
Yeah, I think there is an argument for that. I'm slightly amused that anybody's surprised by this, given that it was voted for in spring conference this year. I know that only we political geeks really pay attention to Lib Dem Spring Conference, and we couldn't really expect the journalists to pick up on it. But yeah, the fact that it's blown up as this big sort of, ooh, big fighting in the coalition today has been a bit of a surprise. But other than that, it's something that I quite like the idea of free schools in principle, but I don't have any objection to there being some sort of minimum standard either. So I'm not that upset by what Clegg said, which is unusual for me. I'm quite good at getting upset by what Clegg said. And I'm surprised that anybody's surprised by it.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting. I've been away this weekend, so I hadn't really paid much attention to politics. Often when I'm away, I still kind of read my RSS feed and do Instapaper stuff, but I hadn't really bothered doing that this weekend. And this morning I came down to the hotel and they had a load of independents stacked up, and it was like front page splash, coalition split. And I was thinking, oh, okay. And then I sat down and the television screen was on, and it was BBC News, and it was, you know, headlines scrolling across the bottom, breaking news, Lib Dem split coalition school's policy. I was thinking, what's happened here? And it turns out what's happened is that all Clegg's done is state Lib Dem policy that was known, like you say, months ago. So yeah, I think it maybe does say a little bit about how the media cover these things, that it's suddenly they realise something that actually, if they'd been paying attention, would have been obvious ages ago.
Yes and no. I mean, let's face it, what happens at Lib Dem conference doesn't always get reflected in government.
How dare you?
Let's take secret courts as an example, which we may come to later. And also, the Lib Dems in government did actually support the legislation that made these schools under these conditions possible.
Well, that's what happens in a coalition, though, isn't it? You support things you don't
Well,
like in order to get other
yes
things
and
you do
no,
like.
but if you it's a bit rich to enact legislation and then turn around and go, oh, nothing to do with me, Gov, I think it's a terrible policy.
Well, he hasn't said nothing to do with me, though, has he? He's said, look, we had to vote for this because of collective coalition responsibility, but we as Lib Dems don't actually like it. I don't think that's something you can really be upset about.
I think you can. I think a lot of people probably who would not support free schools will look at actions rather than words. If you don't want to have a free school, don't have a free school. Don't enact the legislation that makes it happen. There is no action here that has helped the case that he's trying to make. In fact, the action has been complete opposite.
I think there's a possibility that you're sort of not giving the electorate credit for understanding that what's happened. I mean, we all go to work and do things in the workplace that we don't necessarily want to do because the boss has told us to do it. And I think most people understand that.
Well, the boss is an interesting
Well, all right. Well,
an interesting way of looking at it.
the
If we're all being forced to do what the boss
comfort.
says, do we ever get to tell the boss what to do?
Well,
I thought that was the point of coalition, was that the Lib Dems also got to tell the Conservatives to do things that they didn't want to do, and I haven't seen a great deal of that, particularly not when it comes to this education policy.
in this particular case, possibly not, but there have been things, and the big classic thing that I know you don't like Mark bringing up is the raising of the personal allowance, which the Tories were initially massively against and are now trying to claim is their idea.
I don't have any problem with Mark bringing it up. I think if that's what you want to claim as your big win in government, as a tax cut, as a party called Liberal Democrats, it's not the key thing I would think is the take-home message for your party. But you can bring it up all you want and claim credit for it. It's just not what I think. It's not my impression of what a Lib Dem activist would think the Lib Dems are there to do in their sole primary purpose.
Oh, I would probably agree with you on that. I'm just saying it's an example, and it's an easy to bring up example, which is probably why Mark brings it up so often.
It's
Are you
also
saying I'm not on
quite
top of
easy to
my game?
convince a Tory to cut taxes, less easy to convince them perhaps to do something either more liberal or changing our democracy.
But again, this is something that's possibly not necessarily so simple to bring up, but the fact that we didn't let them enact the Snoopers Charter. And okay, it turns out that the GCHQ and stuff have been doing it anyway, but that is something that as a liberal, most liberals would think, yeah, we don't want this. And we stopped the Tories from doing it. And to be fair, Labour were trying to do it as well.
I don't
So.
disagree with you, but again, I've said, and you know that we've had this argument many times, Mark, and I know you listen regularly, Jenny. It's not the same to stop something than to do something.
I think if it's a piece of zombie legislation that keeps coming back and back and back, I think stopping it is something of an achievement.
I'm not claiming it's not an achievement. It's just not. We didn't do X. I don't think is as powerful as we have achieved Y.
Well, I think it's fair to say it's more difficult to sell that on the doorstep, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's not a good thing in and of itself.
It's not a bad thing in and of itself. It's just not. It's not as much of an achievement, in my opinion. Which we've gone over, and again with the going back to the free schools thing, we've done it, but we don't really like it. It's not as strong a message as it didn't happen because of us. So you've got three levels of messaging. You've got we've achieved X, which you haven't been able to get apart from the tax cut, which the Tories are claiming is theirs.
Well, hang on, Emma.
The credit for that.
Emma, the tax cut is not the only policy the Lib Dems have got through. I mean, Mark Pax produced an infographic that's got dozens of policies the Lib Dems have got through. Just because I don't know them all off the top of my head doesn't mean they're not there. They are. So you can't just claim it's just
you,
the tax
thing. As someone who is fairly politically obsessed and a member of the Liberal Democrats don't know more than that off the top of your head, then there's an issue that you're not achieving cut through. You're not, you haven't got flagship achievements. But going back to my sentence, there's achieving X, there's stopping Y, which I think is a good thing, but slightly less than achieving X. And then there's doing X, but really hating the fact that you had to do it, which is an even weaker message than that. And I just think that that's, if that's where you are now, we did it, but we didn't like doing it, is not really, I wouldn't put it on a focus leaflet.
Jenny?
Well, it's not something that I'd necessarily put on a focus leaflet, but it's, I just find it a bit, there were all sorts of things that the Labour government did when they were in power where they said, well, we've had to do this, we really didn't like doing it, but we've had to because terrorists and paedophiles, and they were in power on their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Labour are not a party whose central message is liberalism. We're very divided on issues around security. It's not the core fundamental of what brings us together as a tribe. So therefore, we will be divided on those issues. Some people will not say that we don't like it. Some people say it was absolutely the right thing to do on an issue-by-issue basis. Some people will say it's always the wrong thing to do on an issue-by-issue basis. I personally take it very much. Some things I approve of, some things I disapprove of. I've never been a 100% cheerleader for everything that Labour did in government. I am more liberal than the majority of the Labour Party, but that's not why I'm a member of the Labour Party.
I'm more left-wing than quite a lot of the Lib Dems, but that's not why I'm a member of the Lib Dems.
Exactly, which is why you've chosen to be a Liberal Democrat, which is why I'm always surprised when it's not a liberal issue, but an economic issue, which is being put forward as the key achievement of the Liberal Democrats in government.
Okay.
But the reason why that issue gets put forward is because it's easy to explain. It doesn't take a lot for people to understand it, and you can say it in a sentence. Whereas quite a lot of the stuff that the Lib Dems have done is actually quite complicated and...
Well, again, I think you're underestimating the voters now. I think.
Well, no, I'm not underestimating the voters. I'm saying that if you're talking to somebody on a podcast, you want to say something quick and snappy.
Well, okay, it'll give you some time. What are the best liberal achievements of the Lib Dems in government?
Ooh, the best. Well,
give me five. Take your time.
Do you know what? I'm going to have to go and look at Mark Pack's infographic.
Well, no, hang on a sec. I've just been sitting here for the last minute just thinking. I haven't looked at the infographic. I've used my memory. Ending child detention is one. The pupil premium is another one. The Green Bank is another one. I mean, there are big...
Those are economic.
Yeah, but Emma, every time I'm saying these things, I'm not saying that they're all what you would describe as important liberal in quotes issues. They're all things that were... Like, I think within the top four or five things in our manifesto that we said we would get into a governing programme, and we did do. You know, there are loads of things that the Lib Dems have done. I don't necessarily disagree with your analysis, and I think when we had this argument a couple of months ago, I agreed with you, basically, that it is difficult to point to specific things the party has done that are in, you know, very, very clear alignment with, you know, strong liberal principles. You know, liberal as in, you know, the things like... you know, civil liberties and stuff like that. And it's difficult because our coalition partners are very authoritarian. You know, that's the problem. But the idea that the party hasn't achieved anything, which is this kind of lazy...
They haven't achieved anything to make us a more liberal or more democratic country. And when that's your name, that's hard.
So, Jenny, did you want to get in on this?
Well, yeah, I think the point about child detention is a good one. And also the other big liberal thing, which... some of the other stuff that I'm involved in on the internet is to do with sort of atheist, rationalist, sceptic stuff. The big thing that we did was reform of libel law,
yeah,
which is a massively liberal thing.
Yeah, and very important.
You know,
Why isn't that on the when I ask what's a liberal achievement in government, reform of libel law is a fairly simple sentence.
Yeah, but then people go, well, how have you reformed the libel law? And you have to explain it. And that's a lot more.
And that's how a lot have you more reformed the libel law?
But to be fair as well, Emma, it's not something that's going to cut through on the doorstep, is it? I mean, if you're speaking to someone in like a local council by-election and you start going on about libel law, no one's going to know what you're talking about, or hardly anyone's going to know what you're talking about. And I'm not underestimating the voters. It's just most people aren't interested. That's a quite esoteric issue.
So most people aren't interested, so you should just behave like all the other parties and deal with everything on the left-right spectrum.
But we didn't. We did it. It's just it's not something that's going to get us a massive amount of votes.
But I've been asking you for months, what is the key liberal achievement? And we haven't yet brought up libel law until today.
Yeah, I was aware that it was bubbling along in the background. I wasn't sure quite how far we'd got with it, though, now that Jenny's mentioned it. Maybe
yeah,
you know more about it,
Jenny.
Yeah,
where are we with it? What's happened? What's been enacted? Because I genuinely don't know.
It's the, oh God, you see, this is the thing, I'm putting myself on the spot here.
Welcome to my world, Jenny.
Yeah. Let's do a quick Google. I mean, the other thing from my point of view that's a big win is equal marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Although that was supported by all parties. So that wasn't something, and I think it is genuinely worth, and this is not a partisan anti-Lib Dem point at all. It was very, very important that the Lib Dems supported it, very important that all parties supported it. But I do think that David Cameron deserves a certain amount of credit for pushing it through.
Well, it feels to me like
against an incredible backlash in his party, and I think you do need to say well done to him for that, because
it feels to me like David Cameron's been getting almost all the credit, and Lynn Featherston's had hardly any of the credit, and that doesn't seem fair to me either, because she was very instrumental, albeit a lot was behind the scenes in making that happen.
Well, not all credit to her as well, but it's probably not as hard a sell to her party as it was for David Cameron to his. And I think he deserves the credit for standing up to his party on this one. That's all I mean.
That is true. Jenny, are we getting anywhere on libel reform?
I'm just there's a PDF here of Lord Leicester's libel bill, which is lots and lots of pages that I'm just scanning over. Basically, there is stuff going through the Houses of Parliament, and I don't know what the timetable is on it, but there is stuff going through, and quite a lot of the stuff is things that sort of 2-3 years ago at Lib Dem conference we were having discussions with people like Simon Singh about what needed to be done, and those discussions have fed into what is actually happening.
Yeah,
which is not just the sort of
it's not been an active
reforming libel law is the sort of the headline liberalism thing, but the process that's gone into it is a very Lib Dem thing. You know, it started off with discussions at conference, it went to FPC, there's been consultations, and it's all been refined by various people. And the way it's been done is a very Lib Dem way of doing things.
If anyone listening doesn't speak fluent Lib Dem acronyms, FPC is Federal Policy Committee. I mean, I don't know, Emma, and for anyone listening, might not be too aware of the background of the situation with Simon Singh, but he, I think he wrote an article about chiro practitioners. And then the National Chiropractic Society sued him, I think, for libel. And I think, did they win? Or at least they cost him a lot of money.
They did win, but the cost of even them not winning for him was such, and the cost of time as well as money was so appalling.
Yeah, that was the problem.
You cannot write, it's a chilling thing.
Yeah, that's
people
right.
People won't write stuff like that if the organisations they're writing about will then turn around and sue them for libel.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another important aspect to this as well, which is that you get what are described as libel tourists. So if you have a magazine that is printed all around the world and three copies are sold in London, published in London, then they can be taken through the UK courts. And because the libel laws in the UK are very much in favour of people who are wanting to basically stifle free speech and criticism, then, you know, you have court cases in this country that really have no business being in this country. But because of the crazy way things are structured, they end up happening here. Because obviously the litigants think that they're going to get success here, and they often do. And then actually, it's the chilling effect as well, exactly as you say, Emma. So, it is a very important liberal principle. I think the last time I heard about this a few months ago, I think it was getting bogged down a little bit in kind of politics, which is probably why I hadn't really mentioned it, because I wasn't really sure what was going on with it. But as soon as that goes through, that will be an important liberal principle. But I repeat my point, doorstep ain't going to cut through very much. But just because something doesn't necessarily cut through on the doorstep doesn't mean it's not a good thing to do in and of itself.
No,
just because
I agree.
You might not score many points on a focus leaflet doesn't mean it's not a good thing to do.
But I agree, which is why I'm surprised that it's not being given more prominence on, for example, a political podcast listened to by political geeks like you and I.
So now it has been. And maybe we'll talk about it again, maybe when it actually goes through.
Passes. I think it's a really good law. It's really important. I will happily applaud the Lib Dems and the Coalition if they get it through. And I hope they do.
In fact, my new resolution is to get you to compliment the Lib Dems once every week. You did it last week and you've done it again this week. So let's keep going.
It's a future potential compliment. And I might balance it by talking about the lobbying bill,
which went
to the House of Commons this week.
So let me rephrase it. It's my ambition to get a heavily caveated compliment about the Lib Dems every week. Right. Yeah. Just briefly coming back to the schools thing, can we just slightly unpick a couple of the little aspects of this, of the actual policy? Because I was reading a couple of things today, and something that seems to be a really pivotal issue in this whole process is whether teachers are qualified or not. Yeah. So what Gove has done, and the government has done, is to allow schools, free schools, to be able to choose teachers who actually haven't achieved qualified teacher status. And I think, from my perspective, that actually seems like a good idea, to not have something that is such a black and white, you know, rigid structure, to allow schools to be able to, you know, if they're really struggling to get a teacher who's a specialist in a particular subject, or you've got someone who is brilliant at a particular subject but just doesn't happen to have QTS, because that can take, I think, a year to get, and they might want someone in quite quickly. And maybe they can be fast tracked through to QTS whilst on the job, or maybe not. Maybe it's not necessary because they're just good enough. I'm sure a school isn't going to employ someone who can't teach pupils. Emma, do you think that that's a reasonable thing? Because this actually seems like one of the main sticking points.
I don't think it's necessarily a good thing to have unqualified teachers. I think teaching is an extraordinary profession, one I couldn't consider doing. I think teachers are not paid enough. I think they're not respected enough. I think they are not... we should be valuing teachers like we value bankers. And it, you know, financially rather than emotionally. But I think that the quid pro quo of that is that teachers have to be able to reach a certain standard. And that has to be some form of nationally recognised bottom line. And I think qualification is that. If qualification is taking too long, if there are problems with the way that people qualify, change the qualifications, don't scrap them. I think that our children's education is too important to just be that kind of laissez-faire with it, for me.
See, I was talking to my dad about this earlier today. My dad is a retired teacher. He was initially working in the local education authority school. He was working at a grammar school, and in the mid-80s, the local education authority decided they were going to go all comprehensive. They gave the school that my dad worked at the choice to either go comprehensive or go independent. Prior to going independent, though, they were a voluntary assisted school, which, from what my dad was telling me, is pretty much the same as a free school these days. And this thing about qualified teacher status, it can be a bureaucratic nightmare to get qualified teacher status.
But that's not an argument for scrapping the status, that's for making it better.
What I was about to say is it's possibly Clegg has gone down slightly the wrong route in not saying we should reform the system for qualified teacher status. But of course, independent schools and private schools also have the freedom to hire people that don't have qualified teacher status if they want to.
I mean, so, I think it's...
Well, if we get onto private schools, we might be here all night.
Well, I think, I mean, just coming back to slightly linking this in with what we're talking about, kind of liberal principles. I mean, you know, it's Nick Clegg as the leader of the Lib Dems, and it's kind of, you know, Lib Dem policy to say, you know, to kind of, you know, cover the stuff that Clegg has said today. But, you know, I think that actually you can make a liberal case for allowing schools to employ who they want, even if they don't happen to have the right piece of paper, because I don't think that schools are going to employ teachers who just can't teach pupils. And I think it could be up to you know, to headmasters and the senior management team to decide whether someone is good enough to be able to teach children.
I think that's part of the reason why that's come up this week, though, isn't it? Because of the various scandals around one or two free schools where it's come up that actually they're not. And I think the major problem with the free schools is not that they're hiring people who don't have QTS and whatever and whatever. The major problem is, once one's opened, how the hell do you shut it?
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day in terms of hospitals, actually, rather than schools. And I was thinking about how I can't imagine there ever being a situation where a local MP won't campaign against the closure of a hospital.
Yeah. Even when they're the health secretary.
Even when they're the health secretary. And I was thinking that actually, if we moved to a preventative health model that focused much more of the money, much more of the finance on preventing issues rather than treating once they've become a problem.
Yeah.
Then you would automatically see, hopefully, hospitals closed because there would be less demand. But could that ever be politically acceptable? I was thinking that the success of a preventative health model could be in the celebration of closing hospitals and whether that would ever happen. And I was thinking the same thing. And free schools kind of different because there's not, we're not doing preventative education, or at least I hope we're not, apart from in sexual health, etc. But when the demand for schools is always going to be there, and so, but I can't ever see any party of any stripe closing schools as a matter of ideological rote, which is why Labour have said, we're not going to close the free schools that are there, we're just not going to build more. Because they couldn't just turn around and say to local residents, no, we are closing your schools.
Well, this is
completely untenable.
This is another point that my dad was making, that when he was teaching, the major, whether it came from central government, because there were all sorts of reforms under Kenneth Baker and stuff, or whether it came from the LEA, from his point of view, most of the interference he got from the LEA or from central government was all ideologically, politically motivated by whichever party it was that was in power in the LEA or in government. So he's, in terms of coming back to what Clegg was saying of the, you know, free schools are a great idea as long as they've got some minimum standards, my dad was fully behind that, because he thinks that the best people to decide what is educationally best for local children are the teachers in the schools.
Yeah, and this is a problem that we see time and time again. I mean, I remember even before the general election, Michael Gove was talking about the key stage 3 history syllabus or something. It's like, why
is micromanaging it? Yeah,
exactly. Why is Michael Gove getting involved in the minutiae of what is on the syllabus for kids of a specific age in a specific subject? That should not be in the politician's remit. They should set the general structure and boundaries and then let the education, the educators get on with doing the educating, surely.
Yeah.
But isn't that part of the issue with free schools in that they don't have any local oversight at all? The only oversight is the Secretary of State for Education.
And the Board of Governors and the head and things, but it's in terms of the standards. If Ofsted were to go and inspect all the free schools and find them all to be wanting, there wouldn't be enough people to do anything about it because not connected to the LEAs.
On a separate note, I'm quite interested to get both of your take on this. I saw Charlotte Henry tweeting earlier. She said, I can't remember exactly what she said, but something like, Nick Clegg spent the last 3 years kicking his left. If he now kicks his right, continues to kick his right, and I think this was following the Jeremy Brown move, and then this, which I think she's probably more in favour of free schools, then he'll have no friends left at all. What do you think of that?
My view on Clegg is that I have huge problems with some of what he does, but I still think he's the best man for the job. I don't think there's a credible alternative to him as the leader of the Lib Dems. So until a credible alternative arises, I think he can kick who he wants. It's not
a fan.
I love Tim Farron to bits. I think he's a lovely, lovely guy. I chat to him on Twitter a lot, but I don't think he's a credible leader of the party. Sorry, Tim, if you're listening.
You better get used to the opposite of that, though, Jenny, because I think he's going to do it, after the next election.
I suspect he will, but I don't... He's not someone who can unite the party.
Yeah, you might have a point. As regards your question, Emma, I don't think he really has been kicking the left. It's just that you're in coalition with the Tories, so the compromises that you make are inevitably going to mean that you're part of a government that's implementing more right-wing policies than you'd ideally like. If they were in coalition with Labour, it would be the exact opposite. And I think we discussed this last week, but I don't think Jeremy Brown was sacked because Clegg was trying to have a big clear out of orange bookers from ministerial posts. I think he wanted Norman, I'm more and more convinced he wanted Norman Baker in that role, specifically because in the run-up to the election and after all that had happened with racist van thing and some other stuff, he wanted a very, very strong campaigner who's hopefully going to be a bit of grit in the oyster in the Home Office. And it just so happened that Jeremy Brown was the man there who had to go in order to make room for that. So I'm not even sure that the narrative that's being described there really stands up to that much scrutiny.
An interesting thought from what I perceive to be someone who's quite on the right of the Lib Dems.
Well, maybe we'll get Charlotte on at some point and she can answer for herself about that.
In terms of kicking the left, I think there has been a bit of that, less in policy terms, which, as you say, you're with the Conservatives, and we've already gone around those houses several times tonight, but some of the language that was used about the left of the party has been less than respectful, I would say, from the top. We're a party of government or we're a party of permanent opposition. We can't just be carpet. All that kind of stuff that I think a lot of people felt was very aimed at the left of the party.
Yeah, I would agree with that to an extent. But again, I don't think it's particularly because he's trying to portray that to the wider public rather than to do anything internal in the party.
I think a lot of activists were pissed off with that approach, though, because it ignores the fact that the Lib Dems have been in government in Scotland for eight years. In the early days of the devolved parliament. It ignores the fact that Lib Dems have run councils all around the country. That doesn't stand up to much scrutiny either. But I think you're right, Jenny. I think it's just a political positioning thing, isn't it?
And as far as Jeremy Brown goes, I don't think it would have mattered if he was left, right, centre or sky blue, pink with yellow dots on. The reason he went was because of things like the racist van. He didn't put any sort of liberal stamp in the Home Office at all. The reason he went is because he wasn't effective at his job, and it's nothing to do with whether he was left or right or whatever.
Fair enough. I genuinely was just interested in your take, having read that earlier on, so thank you.
Okay. Right, I think we should move on because we've been on schools and associated tangential topics for about 35 minutes now. We also wanted to talk about what's happened with Andrew Mitchell, which I'm sure we must have talked about before. It's what's known as Plebgate, or as Emma likes to call it, Plebgate Gate. I'm not quite sure why there's an extra gate on the end there, but there you go.
Because it's now a gate about the gate.
Yeah, I heard someone initially calling it Gate. I think they've been waiting for a scandal that involved the gate for decades. They finally got one. I think this has probably been done to death in the media, but it is now starting to look very strongly, and we probably need to still be slightly careful about exactly what we say, but it is starting to look like there's a very strong case for Andrew Mitchell having been wronged in this situation. And not only is there are there very serious questions over whether what has been alleged happened during the actual incident itself in Downing Street, when for anyone who's been living on Planet Zog, he tried to get his bike through the main gate in Downing Street and was told by the police he had to go through a side gate, and he apparently swore at them, but then it was alleged he called them effing plebs. And that was the thing that really blew the whole thing up. And there is a very serious question now over whether some of the accounts that were given by the police of what happened there after footage came out and various other things that look like they just are not compatible with the statements that were given. But then the thing that happened this week is that Andrew Mitchell had a meeting with a number of senior police representatives. And then they came straight out of that meeting and claimed that he hadn't made it clear what had happened, and painted him as someone who was obfuscating and not not being straight about what had happened. But he'd recorded the meeting, and actually it was very clear, he very clearly stated what he'd said and what had happened. So it looks like they weren't being truthful in that situation, and that is what both Theresa May and David Cameron have now explicitly on the record said is basically unacceptable, and that something needs to happen about it. Jenny, what do you think about this?
It's the thing that comes to my mind is the picture that went up on various Labour websites, which was sort of, who do you trust, a Tory politician or a policeman? And when I first saw that, however many months ago that it first came up, I thought, why isn't there an option for neither? Because the police have form for lying about things, and the Tories have form for lying about things. And frankly, although if he had called them effing plebs, that would have been, not particularly polite of him. The police have shot people and then lied about it. So I never understood what the big fuss was about in the first place. I understand that a guy in his position possibly ought to be polite to people, but I have no respect for anybody involved in this on any side, basically. And yes, it is starting to look like he possibly has been wronged, but he surely can't be surprised that people don't trust a Tory politician, or indeed a politician from any party.
I mean, do you think that this might over time change the dynamic of the way that this debate goes? Because now there are increasing calls for a Royal Commission on policing, and to review it basically root and branch, to try and do something about the culture of the police service. I mean, there's an article by Henry Porter in today's Observer, recording this on Sunday the 20th of October. And he just lists a litany of cases where the police have lied, lost in quotes evidence that has then meant that people have been convicted, and then the convictions are later found unsafe. I mean, there's just dozens of them, and that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it?
Well, probably, yeah, but I mean, the vast majority of sort of local bobbies on the beat are doing their jobs to the best of their ability and risking their lives day in, day out, and they're all good people. But there are various things about the way the police works which means that they are going to arrest more black people than white people, and they are going to stop you if you look a bit weird in the street, and
But it
you're going to
seems.
get stopped for having long hair and being in possession of a car and things, because there is always going to be the odd one who's going to take the route of least
But
resistance.
it seemed a little bit more than that to me, though, Jenny. Because I mean, let's take the Ian Tomlinson case from a few years ago during the G20 protests, where, for anyone who isn't aware, he I think he was drunk, and he was trying to get home, but he ended up mixed in with the crowds that were
I
protesting.
didn't think he was drunk.
Maybe he
He
wasn't
wasn't
drunk.
drunk. He wasn't drunk. He was ill.
Okay, fine. I apologize for that. I wasn't totally sure of the details there, but he I think he was moving as if he was drunk, and I think that might have been why the police began to engage with him. But what then happened was that a policeman struck him when he thought that he was being, he was being in some way, either confrontational or not obeying the instructions the policeman had given him. And then a little bit later on, shortly after, he collapsed and then he died. And I think what happened at the time is that that statements were taken, and no police officer said that they saw what had happened. And then footage came out from The Guardian that showed that several police officers were looking straight at the incident when it happened. And then the statements changed and they admitted they had seen something. And that, for me, was a little vignette of the problem, or at least a problem.
Yeah, I mean, they close ranks.
Exactly.
Yes. But that happens in any large organisation. If you ever get any situation where there's a whistleblower, or even in wider society with what feminists call the rape culture, you look at what happened with Roman Polanski.
That was disgusting.
He drugged and raped a 13-year-old child, but the number of people that queued up to say, well, you know, he's not that bad and he's made some really good films, and it's human nature to defend your tribe when somebody is attacking it.
But isn't
going to happen with the police as it happens with party politicians? You know, if Labour starts having a go at Lib Dems, you can hear your hackles rising on this podcast. You defend your tribe. And it's very difficult to fight against that, whether it's with the police or any other group of people. I think it should be fought against, but I don't know how you'd go about doing it.
But isn't the problem, though, that the stakes... Sorry, Emma, just in a sec. Isn't the problem, though, Jenny, that the stakes are so much higher in a lot of the cases where the police are involved? Because sometimes you're talking about people's liberty. You're talking about whether they're going to go to prison or not. So, you know, police surely should be held to a higher standard. And that when police stand up in court and they give testimony, more weight is given to their testimony because they're serving police officers. You know, the stakes are higher. And shouldn't that mean that when police are found to have closed ranks or have lied, that the consequences for doing that should be more severe? You know, if a police officer is assaulted, that is considered more serious than if a general member of the public is assaulted. You know, the corollary of that surely must be that if the police fall short of their standards, then, you know, the consequences should be more severe.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. But because the stakes are higher, when they do close ranks, they're going to close ranks harder.
Emma.
Because the stakes are higher.
Sure. Emma, sorry, I haven't let you in for the last 5 minutes.
Well, just bringing it back to Andrew Mitchell, I mean, I believed that he'd said it. It wasn't just the police saying it. I mean, you had people like Michael Portillo saying, oh, I've totally heard him say it in conversation and stuff.
Did he say I've totes heard him say it?
totes. He definitely used the word totes, yeah. So I believed it, and I apologised to him. He clearly didn't say it. It seems to be very clear that he didn't use the word pleb. He wasn't very nice to people who are working very hard and earning considerably less, and I do judge people for that kind of behaviour. I always say that I judge people by how they treat receptionists, not how they treat the boss. And so I think there was still a case to answer, but this case has become completely centred on the word pleb, and it seems that Andrew Mitchell deserves both an apology and not to have lost his job or to be brought back into government at the earliest opportunity. Because people, if you respect the process around employment rights, as I do, you have to respect that for Tory ministers as much as you do for anybody else. So I would like to take this opportunity to say that I'm sorry I believed it. And also to... to reiterate that the point is that people shouldn't be able to lie to get somebody else a job. If Andrew Mitchell was doing a bad job in other ways, then he should lose his job. But if this is a result of someone losing their job as a result of people lying about them, that's appalling and shouldn't happen. And there should be consequences for the people who are lying.
Yeah, I heard a quote that, the police shouldn't be deciding who is and isn't in the cabinet of the government of the United Kingdom. And I think that probably sums it up. Just as a little aside, I mean, do you think that, I mean, obviously in retrospect, you can say, yeah, it wasn't a good idea. But do you think that the fact that Labour tried to use this as a campaigning tool, do you think that might give them pause for thought, maybe if there was a similar situation in future? Because it's obviously blown up in their face. They couldn't have known the situation. But the fact that they couldn't have known, shouldn't that have meant they shouldn't have done it?
Couldn't have known is an odd thing. I mean, I think we all felt that we knew. I think you felt that you knew. I felt that I knew.
Hands up, I also thought he was guilty. I was talking to Ian Dale at the Lib Dem conference about 2 days later, and he was telling me he didn't believe that he'd done it, and because Ian Dale knows him really well. And I just said, come on, Ian, he must have done it, you know. And you know,
And Ian was kind of saying, well, you know, if he has, he has, but he really didn't think he did. But he was the only person I spoke to who thought he was innocent. Everyone else assumed he was guilty.
But I think sorry, Emma, just that how easy it is to believe that a man like Andrew Mitchell would behave like that.
Yeah.
We've all got this image in our heads of what a Tory cabinet minister is. And if someone says, oh, this Tory cabinet minister was disrespectful to someone he considers part of the lower orders, we all go, yeah, that sounds about right.
I mean, he was disrespectful. Let's not walk away from that completely. But he wasn't. Whether he was because he thought they were part of the lower orders or not is a matter that we now cannot know. But we felt that we knew then. Should Labour be more careful with that kind of campaigning? Yes, I think so. It probably wasn't necessary for that to be run by the party. I think the party should be bigger and better than that. That kind of attack campaigning is not something I'm particularly in favour of. And if people want to do it, that should be people doing it separately from...
Yeah, they should at least swift boat it, shouldn't they?
No, well, no, but I spend a lot of time talking about making politics a better place for everybody. If you've got political parties, for example, straight after the general election, that summer there was the press conference of hate with Chris Huhne and Saeed Awasi, just banging on and telling some fairly big porkies about Labour. And that's the same thing, as that Labour website was a mistake. It was foolish, not because it was wrong, but because that's not the way we should win a political argument.
Yeah. OK, well said. OK, I don't know. Is there anything more we want to say on this before we move on?
I think we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, pretty much.
Yeah, I thought there might be unanimity on this one. OK. Emma, do you want to introduce the next thing? Because I'll be honest, I'm not really up on the detail, but you sent me a link earlier on today to an article in the Mail on Sunday about something to do with some court's victory. Do you want to fill us in on the details?
Yeah, as much as I can. Basically, the Mail on Sunday have been fighting a court case to reveal the findings of a particular case of a person who was accused of being a ranking member of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And this person was released to the Afghan security services. And under the last Labour government, a direct decision by our foreign secretary, who was David Miliband, with a sort of vague promise that they wouldn't be tortured. And then they were tortured. And it seems that there are two sides to the story. One, there seems to be direct proof that although the government asked for assurances that there wouldn't be torture, they didn't follow up those assurances properly. And secondly, that they then held the investigation into what happened in secret, in a court case that directly then led to the further secrets court legislation, rather than because it was a security issue, but because it was politically embarrassing to the government and to senior civil servants.
Surprise, surprise.
So it was interesting to me. I thought I'd raise it because I'm trying very hard on these podcasts whilst presenting a partisan voice, not to shy away from areas where my party could be criticised, and rightly so in this case, quite clearly a massive failing by us overly trusting both security services and promises that were clearly not going to be well kept, and then using the legal system to cover it up. Now, obviously, there are implications in that for the current government in terms of the secret courts legislation, but I just wanted to hold my hands up and say this is something we clearly got massively, massively wrong. Also, to say that on this occasion, because I have been very critical of them in the past few weeks, the Mail seem to have done quite good public service in exposing this. So I thought I'd go a bit counterintuitive and say well done to the Mail on Sunday, and Labour have fucked that one up and shouldn't have done.
Jenny, what do you think about this?
I can't actually bring myself to say well done to the Mail on Sunday, because Christ, it's the Mail. But yeah, this is, it's an issue that those of us who are big on civil liberties and that sort of thing have been saying for God, since even before I joined the Lib Dems, for years and years and years, whenever there's a new piece of legislation that goes through that enables some sort of secret procedure or whatever, we've been saying, look, this is bound to be used to cover something up that's politically embarrassing rather than because it's national security. And, you know, although this happened under a Labour government, and I'm not surprised it happened under a Labour government, it could quite easily happen under this government as well, and it could have happened under the Tory government previous to the Labour government as well. And it's one of the reasons why I'm a Liberal, to fight against this sort of thing. Well done, Emma, for the way you framed it, because you're completely right. It is something that should not happen. And it's why I am, well, it's one of the main reasons why I am in politics, to fight against this sort of thing, for more open, transparent government, and for the right thing not only to be done, but to be seen to be done, which neither apply in this case.
But Jenny, where are we really when you think that, I mean, I sat in Lib Dem conference, they're all merging into one for me now, but it was, I think, last year.
Last year, because I was in that debate. It was quite interesting.
Actually, I might be thinking of the spring conference, actually, when there was a Q&A and secret courts came up, and Clegg was very dismissive. He picked a very specific circumstance that he felt could justify the use of this. So when you've got the leader of the Lib Dems, who, you know, only two and a half years before he did that Q&A and said that, had said in an interview that you shouldn't trust any government, you know, and I thought that was a brilliant interview, because he was absolutely right. Yeah. He even said you shouldn't trust any government, including this one I'm a member of, because, yeah, you know, because power, the nature of power and, you know, secrecy and all the rest of it. And yet he was willing to stand up in front of his own membership at a conference and basically just come out with what I thought was a pretty ropey justification. It was something to do with, because the security services aren't allowed to disclose stuff in open court, they wouldn't be able to defend themselves against some kind of libel or something like that. It sounded pretty ropey to me. Yeah, that was then used to entirely justify that. This entire apparatus and mechanism being instituted. So, I mean, you know, civil liberties are one of the issues I joined the Lib Dems as well, and one of the reasons I'm involved in politics too. But where are we when the party that's supposed to stand up for this sort of thing is just enabling it to happen?
Nick Clegg is not the party. And you know how I said earlier how I quite often have problems with Nick Clegg?
Yeah.
One of my major problems with Nick Clegg is, in this instance and in similar instances, with the Snoopers Charter and things like that, he doesn't react in the way I would expect a Liberal to. And when the party stands up to him and says, no, hang on a minute, Clegg, this isn't Liberal, he'll think about it. And when he's thought about it, he will then say, no, hang on, maybe you're right. But his initial reaction, and I think it is, I don't like saying this, but I think it is because he is from a reasonably privileged background and he's never been in a situation where the people in authority have been against him. So he has that instinctive trust of authority that people from wealthy, privileged backgrounds have, that maybe those of us who are a bit countercultural or who have been on pride marches or whatever, we have an instinctive distrust of authority that I don't think Clegg understands. He might understand it intellectually, but it's not in his blood and his bones the way it is for most Lib Dems.
Emma, what do you think?
I think that's...
Don't you want to intrude on private grief here?
I agree that Nick Clegg is not the whole Liberal Democrat Party, and certainly we've seen that in Labour, where, you know, quite often the leadership would be in opposition to the majority of the party. But we are held accountable as a party for the decisions that leadership took, and. I think there has to be an accountability within the Lib Dems for supporting secret courts through the legislation. And I think that some form of accepting that responsibility and understanding how to stop it in future, because with the greatest respect in the world, I think we are not going to see a Liberal Democrat majority government anytime soon.
Sadly, I think you're correct there.
Given that, and given then you are going to be working with other parties whose number one raison d'etre is not liberalism, it's not, you know, that's not what gets them out of bed in the morning, how do you retain those principles whilst working in coalition better than has perhaps happened this time around? And obviously this time around is the first time, it's a learning curve. So I think it's understandable that a certain amount of mistakes have been made, but in order to really genuinely learn from them, then there has to be an accountability from everybody.
No, I think you're right there. I think you've got a very good point. And I think there does need to be a reckoning on this within the party. How publicly that gets played out is a different matter. I suspect it will happen on the floor of conference, and I suspect it won't be pretty and the media will enjoy it very, very much. But there does need to be some point where somebody who is representative of the vast majority of the party who said no to this stands up to Clegg and says, we told you no, look what's happened. And, you know, it's something that does definitely need to happen, but how or when it will happen is not something I can tell you right at this moment.
Yeah, I think you're right, and that's the feeling I'm getting as well, that there is going to be some kind of reckoning. I think maybe one way in which it might not happen, or at least not happen the way I'd like to see it, is if somehow the Lib Dems end up in government after the next election, because then I think it'll just be back on the roller coaster again, and there probably won't be time to pause and reflect on how it's gone, properly at least. But if we end up in opposition, I'm sure there will be a lot of soul searching, and I imagine the next time, if there is a next time, if assuming there's a break, then it probably will be approached very differently. But I think you're right, Emma, that, you know, it has been a learning curve. It's been a learning curve for everyone. And hopefully lessons will be learned from it. Just before we finish, do we have time to just briefly talk about Labour payday loans policy?
Yeah, yes, let's say yay!
We'll have to be quick, but I'll just outline what's been announced. So, Labour have said that if they get in the next election, then they are going to impose an ongoing tax, so not just a one-off windfall, but a permanent ongoing tax on payday lenders in order to help fund credit unions. And I think I heard some figures today that they think it's going to raise about £13 million a year or something. Does that sound about right, Emma?
I haven't got the figures in front of me. I can have a check if you want, but it might take a bit longer.
Well, don't worry about the exact figures, but in principle, they're going to tax payday lenders and then use that to help expand credit unions. I think they wanted to try and double the number of credit unions is what I heard.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, as we've discussed in the past, it's really important that we do better in terms of credit unions. I've been hearing examples from around the world. The United States, actually, this is a really, really booming area for them. Mm. And they've got lots of people running local credit unions and turning to them. I think it's becoming a huge, huge part of that market, yes, which is great. We don't have that here yet. Let's hope that this announcement helps us to get that ball really, really rolling and start snowballing.
Yeah, I was listening to Moneybox podcast today, actually, from broadcast yesterday. And I think it said that for someone to borrow, I think it might have been £400 over, it was very short term, so like 10 days or something, or 20 days, through the credit unions, it would cost, I think, £19, because like £10 of it was interest and £9 of it was some kind of arrangement fee or admin or something. But with Wonga, that, or one of those payday lenders, that would have cost at least £100 for the same amount of money. So, I mean, it just demonstrates just what a big difference, because you're talking about people who, you know, can barely afford to repay even the lower amount anyway, let alone the higher amount. Jenny, what do you think about this? Do you think this is a policy we should nick quickly?
No, because I think credit unions are a really, really fantastic thing. You know, locally based, responding to local need, etc. That's fantastic. It's something that I, as a Liberal, wholeheartedly support. But I think funding it by taxing payday lenders is only going to mean that the payday lenders will find some way to pass that tax on to the people they are already screwing.
I think that this will not be the only measure that is brought in to deal with payday lenders.
I heard about capping the interest charge.
Yeah, Stella Creasy has now got the job in Labour of focusing solely on this area. And she's been campaigning on this for years, and she really, really knows her stuff.
It's good. And sorry to interrupt, but it's good to see Labour have actually, you know, recognised that and, you know, making very good use of her expertise in that area.
Absolutely. You know, she's been fantastic on this, and she's been brought in to be a, I think the word they're using on Twitter is wongazar.
Oh, God.
which I'm sure she loves. But, yeah, it's a really, really... So I think that this will not be a policy that stands alone in isolation, and therefore Labour are more than aware of the fact that that payday lender's instinct might be to do that, and it will be their job to come up with policy that stops them.
I have a huge amount of respect for Stella Creasy, and I know I shouldn't be saying that because she's not in my party, but I do think that she does there are some things she does that I vehemently disagree with, but a lot of the stuff that she does is really, really good, and she does seem to know what she's doing as well. So I will wait and see what the fallout from this is before I pronounce final judgment.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing about this that maybe just makes me feel slightly uneasy, and it slightly relates to what I think we were talking about last week, Emma, and we also had a bit of a discussion on Twitter this week where you were talking about how there is a potential plan for when, rather than selling RBS off as a, you know, as a kind of going private concern and privatizing it again, that it could be broken up and turned into a load of local banks, a bit like what they have in Germany, which we did discuss at length last week. And I was a bit cool on the idea because I don't like the idea of this sort of thing being imposed from the centre, you know, kind of dictating that the centre is somehow going to create a load of local banks. That I would prefer there to be, you know, for the infrastructure and the mechanisms to be put in place to allow this to happen, but then for them to organically grow themselves so that they're genuinely local, you know, and locally based as well. Is there not a bit of a risk that the government, you know, taxing from the centre and then doling out this money, that you'll end up with a similar thing where it's being imposed from the centre and it just might not work properly?
What matters is what works, Mark.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It might not work.
Well, it might not work, but it might. And I think it's worth trying. And I don't have a problem with the government using their muscle to do that. You and I have very different opinions on state activism. So you won't be surprised to learn that I'm in favour of positive state activism. And if what could be done is impose something from the centre that helps people in localities, then I'm perfectly okay with that.
Jenny, do you have any thoughts on that, finally?
I don't have an issue with government experimentation, let's put it that way. What concerns me is that government will experiment with a policy and then completely ignore whether it works or not, because it's their policy and they like it and they're going to keep doing it, which is what's happened with God knows how many things down the years.
Almost
so, yes.
Every policy, I would say, though, yeah. Jenny.
Just to bring it back circular, free schools, for example.
Yeah, free schools. Oh, I was thinking drugs, which is Mark's favourite thing, which hasn't been mentioned.
Mark, we've got to get off the floor. We can't start talking drugs now. We'll never get him.
No. We've all got beds to go to, so we won't go into that now. Okay. Right. Well, I think that probably brings us to a close. So thank you very much, as usual, Emma, for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks especially to our guest today, Jenny Rigg.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. It's been great. I'd also like to thank Audioboo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week. Realised that for the last half an hour I've been sitting here staring at a screen where on the left hand side it says Q&A, why ministers don't want to tell you a secret, and on the right hand side it says Strictly Sizzling, Ola Jordan shows off her tone dance. It says Simon Cowell's ex Jasmine Leonard gets her wrist tattoo tribute, and there's actually a picture of it and then a close-up of the wrist tattoo, and then at the bottom, the most reprehensible, Emma Thompson's daughter Gaia, 14, is a red carpet pro as she joins her mother for the Saving Mr. Banks London premiere.
Oh, God, the sidebar of shame.
I didn't even really, because I was concentrating on the podcast, I've just been kind of idly, and it's in the last couple of minutes I've realised, fucking hell, I've been staring at the sidebar of shame. This is the insidious influence of the Mail. This is what happens when you open a link to a story on the Mail.
This is why I never, ever, ever click on links to the Mail.
Yeah. absolutely.